everyone. This is one of those crazy days that is the New Hampshire primary. What can I tell you? It's the New Hampshire primary. We have no choice here. It's got to be insane. This is The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and Ken Barnes. Today, this morning, I actually did live Democracy Now!, which then will go up both on the radio and on TV around the country and around the world. So you can watch me about halfway through the show with Norman Solomon. Tonight, I do ABC News. That should be interesting. Had a really interesting conversation with ABC News. And I'm going to apologize because I promised my audience that every day we would start with the words of Colonel Vindman. By mistake, we actually didn't find Colonel Vindman this morning. So I'm just going to remind you that the most important thing you do as you walk into the voting booth, if you're in New Hampshire today, in the future primaries, whenever you actually get to exercise the franchise, but in November, our tyrant in chief needs to be replaced. And as you walk in, it is not just about everything you fear, but it's also about what he did to Colonel Vindman. So I'm going to replace the words of Colonel Vindman today by telling you, remember Vindman. Remember Vindman. He told his father it was okay. With Donald Trump in charge, nothing. Let me repeat that. Nothing is okay. Everything is on the line. There are no norms. The potential is there may not be a democracy. This is a man that is willing to undermine and destroy everything, in part for this reason. Donald Trump is the most frightened little man on the planet. And when you are so frightened, what you have to do is make sure that you keep everyone down. That's what this is about, because God forbid you're a peer and you look him in the eye. And that's really, I mean, it just he's such a small, petty, vindictive jerk. And understand the operative word here is not small hands, small in every way, shape, or form. And small people with this kind of power and this kind of evilness in their mind and the ability to thrash out, he will do it all. You saw it last night in Manchester when he had his rally in Manchester. You're going to begin to see more and more people. They are being escorted out of the White House, escorted out of the administration. You know what his biggest regret is? He can't do it in chains. That's his biggest regret. He wants to make it look like a perp walk. Not an escort, but a perp walk. And guess what? You're the next one to be perped walk out of this country, because that's what this is about. All right, everyone. Vote today. Vote today. Vote today. Don't punt. Don't write in. There are great candidates on the ballot. Make a choice. Don't let someone buy our election. And don't be intimidated by Donald Trump. The best thing to do if you want to confront him is confront him. Don't run away from him. And don't let him manipulate your pencil. It's your pencil, not his. All right, I'm done. I'm off my rant. And I'm so sorry. Tomorrow morning, we begin Colonel Vindman again, and you will hear him in his own voice. But trust me, I admire him. I admire him. I admire his courage. We need his courage, too. I hope his courage is infectious, which is why we're going to read it, listen to him every single day to remember, take some of his and make it yours. All right, what's going on?
So, Arnie, tell us how you really feel about.
I'm sorry, Ken. I'm just shaking. I'm so upset by what I see. I'm so upset. Yeah. And then listening to him last night, and watching his 62-minute rant in the East Room, and then watching his Twitter feed, and then listening to his State of the Union, and listening to his comments about the impeachment, and listening to him literally, basically, just completely hollowing out anyone of integrity in the administration. Integrity mm-hmm. is his enemy. Everyone understand that integrity is his enemy. Yeah. Therefore, it has to disappear.
Well, he is a disaster. And I'm hopeful, however, that we look to a future after Trump. And let's start figuring that out. You're absolutely right, Arnie, that people have to vote and don't write somebody in, but actually vote for one of the candidates who's right. on there. You don't have to love everything about Elizabeth Warren to at least agree with her saying that the party really needs to unite, stop shooting guns at each other across the circle. Yeah. And really, whoever the Democratic nominee is, of the people that are on the ballot, they are good people.
Oh, my God. They're miles
than Trump.
And what I said last night, I was not very good on CNN. I apologize. But one of the things I said on CNN last night was I needed to use this opportunity to sort of put something in that didn't respond
into the question.
Mm-hmm.
Ken, you'll love this. So I reminded the audience on CNN that Bernie set the agenda for 2020. Mm-hmm. And that every candidate is responding to what Bernie Sanders basically said and did. Therefore, all of them have been moved to the left. So they're mm-hmm. all better today because he ran in 2016. Now, there's a lesson there. You don't have to win. You do have to show up. You know, Bernie made a difference. I mean, you can win. I get it. I want you to win. But what Bernie did with his influence on what happened in the future is unbelievable, from what happened in 2018 to the AOCs that you see today to the conversation we're having in 2020. The words he used, the policies he did, they become almost part of the norm. But in 2016, they were at the third rail of politics. Nobody could mention them. Well, guess what? Right. He said you can. It's unbelievable.
He did. And of the candidates who are up there, Amy Klobuchar is the only one who raised her hand and said that she was troubled by Bernie and his socialist label. Mm-hmm. Everybody else apparently has the courage to look beyond labels and just say, these are policies he's proposing, which are, as Warren says, at the core of the Democratic Party. I mean, this is what the Democratic Party has stood for since Franklin Roosevelt.
So she always talks about she wants to do things that are doable. That's what Amy says.
Mm-hmm.
So here's my question, Amy. Okay, after you do that, what's the next step? Okay, you want to move incrementally. In what direction? Where do you want to go? You want to expand the Affordable Care Act? To what? To what?
Right. What's her vision of how healthcare gets to be good enough in America, and also how long it's going to take in her vision?
Well, it's so again, I go back to the minimum wage. I mean, we have seen an explosion of states and cities that have braced the minimum wage. Mm-hmm. We have seen Jeff Bezos get beaten into raising the wages for his employees as he's the richest man on the planet, everyone. But it was because Bernie kept exposing it. Bernie kept exposing it. And guess what? Jeff had to lose, I think, one millisecond of his gazillions of dollars so he could actually give people a way to live on the wages that he pays them. So,
and, of course, he's not paying any taxes.
Well, look at all that extra cash he has laying around.
Yeah.
You know, that he's not giving to the federal coffers like you and me. We pay more in taxes than Jeff Bezos. And I don't care whether you're a maid. I don't care whether you're a college professor. I don't care whether you're a student working a part-time job. You are paying more in taxes than Jeff Bezos. What's wrong with this picture?
Absolutely, what's wrong with this picture. Oh. That is just not what America is supposed to be about.
Yep, yep. All right, everyone. Okay. We're technically not supposed to be talking about the primary today, but we're sort of doing that. I decided that I saw a piece, again, at my favorite site on the planet, theconversation.com. You know I love it. And I urge you to go there. You may find content that you like. You may not. But I think at least 90% of the time you will learn something from that site. And what I liked about this was it was an analysis of the last debate before the New Hampshire primary. And if you listened to me last night on CNN with Anderson Cooper, if you listened to me probably tonight on ABC News because ABC was the one that hosted the debate, I am going to tell you that never have I thought that a debate would be pivotal until now. And the debate before the New Hampshire primary this time was pivotal on so many levels. Part of the reason why it was pivotal was that ABC News did a really good job in this debate. One, they had a smaller cast of characters. So trust me, it helps not to have 10, 11, 12, too many people on the debate stage. But they still had a significant number. But what they did was they allowed people to really have a full fleshed out answer and be able to kind of respond to the other people on the stage. It was really a dynamic discussion of policy. You allowed people to have a full-throated conversation during the course of the debate, and a lot of real substance came out. Now, here's the good news, bad news. Substance matters, perhaps, for the Democratic base. Sadly, I don't know if substance is going to matter when you're going against the liar-in-chief. But at the same time, what we need to know is let's make the assumption that you defeat the liar in chief, which I have to believe in. Then you need to know what they think, where they're going, and how they process everyone. And that was what was so useful about the debate the other night. And then one last thing before I bring in two of the professors that wrote this piece. Actually, three were part of it, but we could only get two on the line. Let me just say one more thing. And I mentioned this to a reporter from ABC Tonight. And then I said, let me share something with you. The reason why Amy Klobuchar
is spiking, and Warren is somewhat getting lower expectations, in part had to do with that debate. And it's not even about her answers. It's that she seemed to disappear on the debate stage where Amy seemed to reappear on the debate stage. And I'm going to give you two numbers, everyone. Because Elizabeth Warren was higher in the polls, she got 7 questions. Amy lower in the polls, she got 4. But guess what? Amy had more time on that debate stage than Elizabeth Warren. Why? Because Amy took the time. Let me remind you, this isn't just about good policy. It's about knowing how to play the political game. Amy showed that she had elbows because she elbowed herself into the conversation. I know you hate it, Ken, but in the end, it's a sort of a monopoly page, and you can't just win one of the houses on the monopoly stage. You got to sort of figure out what your strategy is, and your strategy just can't be good policy. It has to be able to play the political game as well, and that is where that night Elizabeth should have known she needed to excel. She didn't. I better bring my two guests, or they're going to hate me. All right, gang, thank you so much for joining us. You can tell I'm hyperactive because today is the primary. Joining us right now is an assistant professor of public relations at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Joseph Kabowski is joining us. Also joining us is Aaron Call. Call or Call? How do you pronounce your last name, Aaron?
It's Call.
Call. Perfect. Aaron Call, he is the Dean of Students at the University of Michigan. The title of your piece was you were asked sort of to pull the standout quotes from the New Hampshire Democratic debate, and then you explained why you pulled these quotes. They were fabulous. I thank you so much because it gave me an opportunity to think long and hard about this. I'm going to start with Aaron, and then Joseph, you're going to do the cleanup act. So Aaron, you looked at the quotes, and you looked at Tom Steyer and what he said about the economy. So why did that seem to be the standout quote for you, and why do you think that that's important as we move into 2020, when at least technically on paper, Donald Trump can crow about this economy, low unemployment, a stock market going out of style, you know, all that kind of stuff that at least sounds good until maybe you sort of go beyond the headline.
Yeah, I thought the timing of the quote was interesting because we just earlier that week had James Carville, the one who coined the phrase, have a big interview and him talking about the Democrats, you know, losing their mind and being upset that it looked like maybe a moderate wouldn't prevail. And you combine that with President Trump's State of the Union address earlier in the year, where I was very surprised that he had the discipline to not talk about impeachment like he did in the previous address. And instead, the very beginning of the speech, I thought was powerful when he talked about a lot of the economic indicators that was positive, the economy, the unemployment rate, stock market, as you mentioned, economic growth. And so I think Steyer was, you know, just saying that a president that has those economic benefits in 2020, an incumbent president with all the other advantages that come with that, it's going to be very difficult to beat. And certainly he was trying to use that as an advantage for him, being that he's a successful, you know, business person that's made a lot of money. Although I guess a problem for him, even though he's not on the debate stage yet, is that Michael Bloomberg is even a more successful business person, is doing better than him in the polls.
Well, let me just say something else, Aaron. And again, one of the things that you definitely know that Donald Trump, I felt, listened to listen to what's-his-name's wife, who's happened to be the Republican operative in the family. Carville's wife is a Republican.
Exactly.
So what I also thought was he also turned around and said to, you know, the black community and the Hispanic community, and look at how well you're doing. Lowest unemployment ever. So it wasn't just generic in the way that you would say, oh, well, but look at the economic spectrum. He literally targeted those audiences as he took credit for this remarkable economy. And again, that's another reason why I'm glad Tom Steyer talked about it. But I don't know if you know this, Aaron, but we had a fellow on from the American Prospect. And one of the things that came out in the course of the conversation is one of the reasons why the bottom 20% of income earners have seen their incomes rise is because so many cities and states around the country have raised the minimum wage. And when you raise the minimum wage to $11, $12 from $7.25 or whatever, all of a sudden it's not necessarily because of the competition in the economy. It's because government had to step in and bring up the bottom. So
definitely, and that's something that, you know, the national minimum wage has not increased since the Obama administration. That's something certainly that wouldn't happen under a Trump presidency. So we're seeing other, you know, states and locales are doing that, even private companies like Amazon and others. And so clearly that's you know, an argument in favor of a Democratic candidate in this race. And I think you're exactly right that, you know, President Trump mostly plays to his base, and yet, you know, there's certainly room for growth amongst African-American and Latinos, given especially amongst African-Americans how poorly he did in 2016. And so this economic argument, in addition to many others, is certainly part of an overt campaign of targeting these type of voters to try to expand his appeal, you know, as the race in 2020 is going to be close no matter what.
Okay, and then I'm going to go to Joe, but one more comment here, and that is everyone's talking about this economy, and the question really is do you have a job? Yes. It's called the affordable challenge. Can you afford a apartment? Can you afford the food? Can you afford the, you know, and so it becomes where that is part of the problem. You may have two or three jobs, but if you still can't find an apartment to live in, what's the point of two or three jobs? If you can't afford the copay and the deductible, what's the value of the two or three jobs? And I think that's another kind of interesting drumbeat. You know, if there's something wrong here, it's that there's something wrong with work. When you can work so hard and work so long and still not be able to get the basics for your family. And that'll be an interesting thing to see whether the candidates pick up on those comments that Tom Steyer said, as well as James Carville. But you're absolutely right that I think it was an important thing to pull out of that Democratic debate. All right, Joe, let's turn to you next, and then we can have a three-way conversation. You talked about the fact of Bernie Sanders. So why don't you talk a little bit about what you did? Because I found what you wrote about, and I shared it with a million people, by the way, because I thought your analysis was really, really interesting and really actually depressed me more than you could possibly imagine.
Well, so here's the thing. So I pulled out a quote from the debate where Sanders had talked about, you know, even with the question was about, you know, lower than expected turnout, and Sanders' argument was, yes, but we still got youth vote up over 2008 when Obama had this big coalition. And so my analysis focused on, you know, I don't want to call that completely untrue, but, you know, at best it's misleading, in the notion that it is true that just based on the entrance polls, youth turnout, you know, moved up from 22% to 24%. So I'm pretty sure that's where Sanders was getting his claim. But as we know, overall turnout was down dramatically, you know, about 20%.
Right.
So that actually means youth turnout overall, you know, 22% to 24%, pretty negligible. But when overall turnout drops so much, that still means we have a huge, huge problem of turnout. You know, and it's not just the youth. And right. So a lot of what I, you know, kind of obsess about and like to work on are, I'm a data-based public relations person, and I think a lot of times there are all of these narratives, and I almost always play on the other side of the sandbox of here are the things that we're talking about.
Right.
We kind of portray them as truth. We know that people, especially on the Democratic side, don't like Donald Trump. We know Democrats in 2018 were very excited, and now we actually have real numbers that are showing, uh-oh, if you're a Democrat, this is a problem. And, you know, and it's not just based on a youth dynamic, but we had pretty much turnout down across the board.
Yes.
And there could be a few reasons for that. You know, I think it's interesting that we have turnout about down in Iowa about 20% from 08.
Mm-hmm.
But the other thing that switched in Iowa by 20%, Obama, you know, won this purple state Iowa by about 10 points. He won in a landslide kind of the first time in 2008. Trump made Iowa not competitive any other way. And won by about 10 points.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, is that a flight of folks? I think a lot of people focus on it's just a messaging problem.
No.
But, you know, look at that over 12 years. There's a shift, you know, in the way of a state like Iowa, of people moving from the Democratic Party to the Republican Party, or even if they're not Republicans, tuning out, not voting, whatever it might be, and the Democrats really need to come up with a new answer that's more than just kind of, these micro-narratives.
Do you think it's a shift, like a trend that's going to continue on the same trend line, or is it just depends on this year the issues and the candidates are X, Y, and Z, and they're talking about this? You don't know that the trend line is going to continue for another
point. No, not at all. And that's why I think New Hampshire's, you know, I'm glad we're talking about this today,
yeah,
because
exactly.
I love trends, but at the same time, Iowa does not make a trend.
Exactly.
But we're gonna find out from New Hampshire today
Right.
Is this going to happen again?
So Joe, let me just say something. So Aaron, I agree with you about the economy, and I'm going to go back and pivot back to the economy. But Joe, thank you so much, because I have been giving everyone a knuckle sandwich. I have been talking about this and saying, how is it possible that with Donald Trump as president, you didn't have the highest participation rate, you know, ever in Iowa history? I mean, I understand that you were swept away by Barack Obama, but this is even more frightening because you have a tyrant in the office. And if you care about your country and you care about your children not to participate, this is an even more strategic reason, especially since everyone was saying it'll have the highest turnout here and the highest turnout there. And then to see that what they were predicting didn't translate. And I said to New Hampshire, you better disabuse everyone that that was an anomaly, that that was not a pattern, as you said, Ken, because I think it's so important. But Aaron, I want to go back to you and what Tom Steyer said about the economy. Part of the reason why I think you see the numbers going down in Iowa is that you're right. Barack Obama won by 10 points initially. They definitely were excited about his hope and change, and they believed him. And they thought that, I'll use Amy Klobuchar, that he would see them. All right? Let me use that line, that he would see them. And what happened in the 8 years that he was president is that he didn't see them. He returned Wall Street to stability. We saw the stabilization. He may have given us the Affordable Care Act. But when, you know what, you're looking at a job still and you're seeing flat wages and you're seeing a greater gap between rich and poor and all those things happening and your kids going into debt in order to go to college, what they were disappointed. So I think what you're seeing in this turnout in Iowa was not only a reflection of maybe, I don't know what, that they were not as excited about their choices. I think it was also a sense of majestic disappointment that when the Democrats were in charge for 8 years, what really happened in their lives and are they better? What do you think of that, Aaron?
Mm. Yeah, definitely. I think that's you know, an argument you're seeing people like Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren make, certainly on the debate stage, even during the last debate. I believe it was Elizabeth Warren who said that the economy, you know, is not working for certain people.
Right.
And so, you know, I think that's true, and it'll be interesting to see what the turnout is in New Hampshire. I know they've scaled back the projections a little bit. And also, I think because there's you have a lot more candidates this time, I think could
right.
be another a reason before you had, you know, maybe two candidates. And so when the field is larger like this and you have some people in the field still not even participating in this, maybe something else. But, yeah, I think that a lot of people, certainly for Bernie Sanders, the argument was, you know, could increase turnout and, you know, from non-traditional people, and maybe it's a little bit tougher to, you know, turn out. It requires more commitment for a caucus. But once we get in New Hampshire, and if those numbers still remain the same, then I certainly think it hurts the argument a little bit that, you know, bringing non-traditional voters out as opposed to the model in 2018 of, you know, winning more moderates and you know, independents, maybe that some people that didn't vote in 2016 or voted for Trump, and which were responsible for Democratic gains. And that, you know, may be a better strategy for a general election,
right.
depending on what the numbers look like after New Hampshire.
So, Joe, Joseph Kabowski is a University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. He's the one that pulled out the numbers and then did the math. You've got to read it. I posted it on Facebook, Joe. I just want to let you know. I've been telling everyone. I'm sort of warning them, okay? But there's a problem here, too, and I don't know. It didn't happen in Iowa, but it could happen in New Hampshire. There has been a real push, especially in Republican-controlled states where they have Republican governors and people that can sort of make a difference in what policy looks like, to basically suppress the student vote. And we have seen voter suppression targeted at young people in my state. So even at the same time as we want people to be enthused and we want them to participate, we also have seen this real drive for voter suppression for poor people, people of color, you know, people who maybe move, you know, people who have a criminal record, you know, young people. And that becomes problematic because even as you're trying to expand the franchise and encourage people to come in, they have even higher hurdles than their old white parents.
So you know, there are two aspects here that I think are important. The first is you're talking a lot about initiatives in red states, right, that become policy that legally are disenfranchising people.
Yes,
that's a huge problem. But I'll tell you, you know what I saw on the ground, Arnie, in Iowa, was the way that narratives can disenfranchise people. I went to on caucus night. I was there with a research team, and I had a small team of folks from UNC, and we went to one of the only Spanish language caucus sites in Des Moines. Okay. It was the only one in Des Moines, and there were only six in the state. And this was the first time that they did it.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm sitting there in a room of 95% of people, almost all Latinx, a lot of younger voters. Many were first-time voters. And they are watching narratives from Iowa where the party screwed up. The voters didn't screw up, but the party did.
Yeah.
And they're watching the narratives that say, you know, this is great for New Hampshire, but they're watching narratives that say, I came out, I'm first-generation immigrant, I've never voted before.
Right.
Oh, by the way, they were 95% for Sanders because his campaign turned it out.
Mm-hmm.
But they're now watching narratives that say, okay, Iowa screwed up, the party screwed up, so let's just start over in New Hampshire. Well, that's a narrative disenfranchisement. Form of disenfranchisement.
Right.
And I think the other thing, you know, you were talking about the difference between Klobuchar and Warren in the debates, but I'll tell you, you know, there are narratives against the Peak campaign with minority voters, but there were only two campaigns that bothered to send an official representative to this caucus site, and that was the Sanders campaign and the Buttigieg campaign.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, there's this assumption that Biden is going to do well with minority voters. There's this assumption that the Warren campaign was super organized. And again, I know it was a new dynamic, but that's kind of the point.
Yep.
Is if you're that kind of voter and you only see two campaigns, and even though, you know, they weren't Buttigieg voters, you know, at their core, again, at least they showed up. Versus the Warren or the Biden or the Klobuchar. Okay. And that's why we see these narratives about Joe Biden saying he's going to go to places like South Carolina. And
with
even though a state like Iowa is not that diverse, a place like Waterloo, which is based in Black Hawk County, Sanders won 31% of Black Hawk County. Waterloo is one of the only cities in Iowa that it's about 15% African American.
Mm-hmm.
Buttigieg won 24%, and
mm-hmm.
Biden gets 14.5%. In other words, in one of the only diverse counties in Iowa,
he didn't show.
He did worse than his statewide average.
So let me just say something. And so that's one of the issues I have with Amy Klobuchar. So Amy Klobuchar is a neighbor of Iowa. Did anyone mention this? Minnesota is a neighbor of Iowa. She had no ground game. No ground game for the most part. Once again, in New Hampshire, she has no ground game. And so even though she excelled in the debate, the question is, can you just take a debate performance and turn it into a GOTV and get out the vote? She is lucky. And you know why she's lucky, Joe? Because everybody is so torn between four candidates. I mean, four candidates. They don't know what to do. And so that last debate actually had so much meaning because they were torn between four candidates that they could actually say, oh, well, she did so well. Maybe I'll choose her. But normally that doesn't happen and will never happen in South Carolina and won't happen in Nevada. So it's going to be very interesting.
And if you think Buttigieg's numbers are bad with minorities, you should look at hers.
Oh, I know.
They're far worse.
I mean, literally
the asterisk.
All right.
And without the organization. And that's why I think it's clear she's been the best debater. I think Sanders' campaign is clearly organized and
yep.
is doing much better
yep.
than 2016,
yep.
although now he's got many competitors. And Buttigieg, honestly, by being in room with Buttigieg,
yep.
everybody around me says, this guy feels like Obama.
Yeah.
And you don't see it in a debate. Just like Obama, he's pretty good but kind of wonky.
No,
but in person, he gives a great speech, and it's the only venue that feels like hope. And so you've got all of these candidates with strengths, but as I think you've said before, they also have a lot of flaws, and everybody's torn between the flaws.
I need to let both of you go. Thank you so much. I think I'm keeping you both on my Rolodex so I can call you again. I really appreciate it. And keep writing for theconversation.com. It's such a valuable site. Anyway, thank you so much. We will talk to you soon. Ciao.
Thanks, Arden.
You're welcome.
Thank
Bye-bye.
You.
All right, everyone, a little labor history is next. This is The Attitude on Primary Day.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1903. That was the day that workers in Oxnard, California, took a united stand and showed the power of solidarity. Oxnard was a California boom town. The American Beet Sugar Company, owned by the Oxnard brothers, drew hundreds of workers to the area. These new arrivals included Mexican and Chinese agricultural workers who faced hostility from local white residents. The managers at Oxnard exploited this interracial tension. They intentionally exacerbated conflicts between the groups of workers in an effort to keep wages low. This animosity heightened even further when the federal government passed the Chinese Exclusion Act, severely restricting Chinese immigration to the United States. As the number of Chinese workers at the factory fell, the company recruited Japanese workers to take their place. They wanted to continue to divide and exploit their workforce. They required their employees to shop at a company store. They also paid their recruits less than was originally promised. But the company had miscalculated. The workers were fed up with these tactics. 500 Japanese workers and 200 Mexican workers walked off the job. Soon the number of striking workers had grown to more than 1,000. One Mexican worker was killed during the work action, and four other strikers were injured. But the workers stood strong together. The company eventually caved to the demands of the workers. The victorious workers then applied for union affiliation with the American Federation of Labor. But the AFL refused to admit the new local because it included Japanese workers. It would take a few more decades before the lesson of solidarity taught in Oxnard, California, would begin to be embraced by the U.S. labor movement. Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. If you hike into the Cascade Mountains of the Pacific Northwest, you'll find yourself in the midst of dense conifer forests. At mid to high elevations, winters are wet. And in summer, snow from higher up the mountain melts and waters the trees. But as the climate warms, some of these areas are getting drier, and the forests are becoming more vulnerable to frequent and severe wildfires. Sebastian Busby is a research analyst and PhD student at Portland State University. He says that in the burned areas he studied, some important tree species, like subalpine fir and mountain hemlock, are struggling to grow back.
After these big severe wildfires, it created sort of this like hellscape of sorts where it's extremely dry, there's no shade, there's no organic soil on the ground, and those species don't really like those conditions.
The trees that are coming back are more drought-tolerant species like lodgepole pine, and they're spaced farther apart. Busby says this could reduce timber harvests and diminish the mountain's unique beauty. But it is also how the forest will adapt to climate change.
The spark of hope is that it's already organizing itself to be more resilient to the future wildfire patterns we expect.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
What a great line. Let the folks in. This is The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and Ken Barnes. Today is primary day. I've got too much on my plate. I'm screwing things up. I apologize. But what I know I did not make a mistake on is, one, having Ken pick that song. Who sings that?
That's Billy Paul singing Let Him In.
Let Him In. And before I introduce my guest, I need to let her know that I tweeted this out. I Facebooked this quote from your column. Our racist Islamophobic president by the numbers. The number of Muslim refugees admitted into this country between 2016 and 2018 shrank by 91%. By 91%. When I tweeted it out, by the way, I think it was retweeted by a group of people that work with the resettlement community and whatever. So thank you so much. And again, I want to give people every reason to replace Donald Trump, every possible reason. And you just reinforced one of those reasons. Joining us right now is the author of the piece at HuffPost.com, and it was entitled, "By Targeting Africans, Trump's Muslim ban is even more racist," advocates say. "It's no coincidence these nations were targeted, especially in light of Trump's comments
about Africans. Joining us is Rowida. Is that correct, Rowida?
Yes, that's correct.
And pronounce your last name.
Abdelaziz.
She's a reporter based in New York City, where she focuses on Islamophobia and social justice, which means we're calling you back for sure, and issues facing the Muslim community. She is fluent in Arabic. She's also written for numerous stories on the Middle East and covered the refugee crisis in Syria, Yemen, and other parts of the Arab world. Really, welcome to the program. What a wonderful, powerful piece. There's so much being thrown at the wall that we can't hold on to it. So I almost start with an apology, because as I read these stories, I'm going, when did they do this? When did they do this? Because the level of evil and hatred and marginalization is overwhelming, but that I think is intentional. So we can't focus on anything because it's all coming at us. So please talk to us about what just recently happened last week when he announced the expansion of his controversial travel ban.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much for having me, and thank you for dedicating time to talk about this. I think people forget that this travel ban has been enacted, and it's been active since 2017. There have been multiple iterations, but I think to start with the latest news, so we know that last week Donald Trump announced the expansion of his travel ban, where he added several more countries to the original list in 2017. So this is not replacing the old list. This is not doing away with the old ban. It's keeping the old ban intact that had seven countries on it, five of them being Muslim majority. And then we added several more nations now. So the new countries that have been added to this new ban now target immigrant visas from Myanmar, Eritrea, Kazakhstan, Nigeria, Sudan, and Tanzania. And what makes this new ban, I think, all the more horrific, and why people are saying that not only is this a Muslim ban, but it's even more racist than what it was, is because out of the seven new added nations, four of them are African countries that have sizable or Muslim majority countries. So this is not negating that this isn't a Muslim ban, that this isn't targeting Muslims, but now we're targeting Black Muslims, right, and Africans. And a lot of people are saying that this is not a coincidence, right? Because if we look in 2018, Donald Trump had referred to several African nations as shithole countries during an immigration meeting.
We're quoting the president, everyone. We're quoting the president. Don't bleep me. I want to make sure you hear the word. We're not going to muzzle it. We're going to hear the word. All right, keep going.
Yeah, and just the year before, right, in 2017, he allegedly said that Nigerian visitors to the country would, quote, never go back to their huts. And this is, again, another meeting that was held because he was angry over the number of visas that were awarded to them. So this is not a coincidence. These countries were not picked out of a hat. When you put it into full context of the different countries and of the different comments he said about these countries, again, when we look at the original Muslim ban, where Trump said on the campaign trail that he wanted to shut down, right, and completely ban Muslims from entering the United States, and that Islam hated us. All of this then makes sense for immigration lawyers and advocates to say that there is malice, xenophobia, Islamophobia, and racism that are behind passing these legislations. And that's what these legislations do. They institutionalize racism and they institutionalize Islamophobia.
And I want to just give people some numbers here from your article. But everyone, go to HuffPost, go to my Facebook page, go everywhere, read this. More than 12,000 people are expected to be impacted per year, according to the Department of Homeland Security spokesperson. So I just got to ask a question. What's the spin in the expansion of his travel ban? Like, what's the argument against the four African countries? What did he say? I mean, I understand what he thinks, and I know what he wants to do. But there's a difference between what he thinks and what he wants to do and the sort of at least generic justification for what the hell he's doing. He's got to package it with something that at least appears on its face to be real.
Absolutely. And so what the Department of Homeland Security has been telling reporters, and when this news broke, what they told us last week, is that the reason why these countries were targeted because they have failed to meet U.S. security and information standards, right? So the U.S. has cooperations with governments across the world where they share information about foreign nationals. And so this is how they kind of conduct some background checks and learning other types of information. So when these folks, you know, travel or want to enter the U.S., et cetera. So according to the U.S., these countries have failed, right? On paper, the official explanation is that they, you know, their security standards and their information sharing standards is not up to par. But when you're looking at, I think, the president's comments, and when you're looking at the details of the ban, you know, people and have argued otherwise. So, for example, I think when the first ban came down in 2017, as we all recall, there was mass chaos. People who were on the plane, they didn't know if they were going to be able to get off the plane and enter the U.S. People who were already given valid visas and were going to travel the next day, the next week, the next month. There was so much logistical confusion that you can tell when the first ban came down that the administration hadn't really thought this out. This time, 3 years in, they kind of cleaned up their act a little bit, and there's a little bit more organization. So this time, the U.S. is saying that they are suspending immigrant visas. And so immigrant visas are the type of visas given to people who are seeking to live in the U.S. permanently. So they're not tourist visas, they're not student visas. Even though those were banned the first time around, the U.S. is now saying technically you can come on a student visa if you're coming from these countries, but if you're seeking the lottery, if you're trying to seek safety, if you're fleeing persecution and you want to live here permanently, we are no longer going to allow that. And so it is still, it's a different type of ban, but there is very strict travel restrictions, but it doesn't make it any easier. And our advocates have argued that this is just withholding a type of white supremacy, right? That the people who are coming, they're Black, they're Muslim, they're not coming from countries that are white majority countries. And so many people have argued that by filtering in certain type of people based off of their ethnic, religious, and racial background is a form of discrimination, which is why these bans have been challenged in the courts repeatedly. It went up to the Supreme Court, which was upheld, I think, to the dismay of many. But they brought it back to the lower courts where they continue to challenge it.
So explain to me this concept. How did he say that these countries from Sudan and Tanzania will no longer be issued diversity visas? Can you tell me what a diversity visa is to start with? And if you're saying to these countries that you can't use the diversity visa, so the only countries that can use the diversity visa are what? Denmark, Sweden, Norway? I'm just out of curious. What does a diversity visa mean?
Right. So all of the countries other than, like you mentioned, Tanzania and Sudan, all immigrants are going to be barred and they cannot enter. Countries from Sudan and Tanzania can still enter. Oh, and before that, and this is very similar to the first ban where Libya, Yemen, Iran, Somalia, Somalia, North Korea, and Syria, all immigrants and non-immigrants were banned. Venezuela just had certain government officials and their family members that were impacted. But when we're talking about a diversity visa, the diversity visa is also known as the green card lottery. It's a U.S. government program where it establishes, it gives a certain amount of visas to people of different countries on a random basis where when people apply that they're given the opportunity to come to the U.S. legally, to be set up to receive permanent residency so then they can find a job, they can petition for family and spouses, and are given an opportunity to live in the U.S. And so those type of visas, the diversity immigrant visa program or the green card lottery program, is going to be suspended for those two nations.
So we're talking to a reporter from HuffPost, the title of her piece, by targeting Africans, Trump's Muslim ban is even more racist, as if it's possible. Advocates say it's no coincidence that these nations were targeted, especially in light of Trump's comments about Africans. So I just need to know. So let's talk about how people are reacting and how the Democrats are fighting back, number one. And then number two, one of the reasons why I also want to do this is that this actually impacts Minnesota in some ways more than almost any other state in the nation. And you can maybe explain to people why I say that, because I think it's also a question that I would like to sort of pose to Amy Klobuchar since she's running for president. Obviously, this is what Donald Trump is doing to get her take in a public setting to maybe draw some light to this problem.
Absolutely. Minnesota, like you mentioned, is the state with the most refugees per capita. And so Minnesota has been under intense scrutiny and hysteria by the right-wing media saying that, you know, Minnesota is no longer white. It's being overtaken by immigrants and this concept of Sharia law, right, this boogeyman type of law is going to take over, and that the U.S. doesn't want to become like Minnesota, which is one of the furthest stereotypes that we've ever heard of.
Right.
But when you look at Minnesota and people who have come out of there, we have our, you know, one of our first Muslim congresswomen who hailed from Minnesota, Ilhan Omar, et cetera. and that has produced an amazing amount of work, an amazing amount of labor and workforce and other contributions by the immigrants there. But when I've spoken to advocates when this new ban had passed, a lot of them have told me that their clients are worried and they're really scared. There have some people who are planning to go back to these nations to either attend weddings, funerals, just to go visit, and they've canceled their plans. Right. There have been people who are attempting or in the middle of petitioning for families and spouses to seek medical treatment, and those plans were also thwarted. People are kind of in a frozen state where they don't really know if it's safe for they themselves to travel anywhere. They're afraid of the American borders. They've heard about the ill treatments of Africans and Muslims at the borders, and they don't want to be subjugated to the same thing. So people are kind of put a pause on their lives. They've canceled their own plans. They've canceled their family's plans because they feel like they need to get in touch with lawyers. They can't go on a vacation without saying, what happens if I get detained? What happens if I'm questioned? What if I'm an American citizen? Am I still going to be subjugated to discrimination, which has happened? You know, we've seen it happen to Iranians on the Washington border, and this happens all the time. So there is an intense fear, I think, to a lot of people all over the country, in Minnesota and other states, who are trying to figure out what their rights are, and even if they have rights, if that's even going to mean anything nowadays, right? And so in regards to Democrats, there have been a number of bills and legislations that have come out. In fact, tomorrow, the House Judiciary Committee is going to be hosting a hearing on the No Ban Act, which is the National Origin-Based Anti-Discrimination for Non-Immigrants Act, very long. It's an act that was introduced that would effectively terminate Donald Trump's travel ban, and it would also prevent any presidents from kind of enacting a similar ban. It's widely supported by Democrats. And so that's happening tomorrow, and I think it's something that we should keep an eye out on. And so we'll see. The Nancy Pelosi announced that she would support it. We don't really know how it's going to go. We know that Republicans are most likely are going to fight it. But tomorrow we're going to find out.
So exactly what – so I we're going to call it the No Ban Act. It's simpler that way. So so what does it basically do is say that the president and any future president has no authority to ban X, Y, and Z? Like, what is the – flesh out what the No Ban Act says. Because, again, we cede so much power and authority to the executive branch when it comes to certain things that are engaging in these kinds of issues, because obviously they can pull something, some rabbit out of their hat about some kind of potential threat, whether it's real or Memrex. So tell me, what does the No Ban Act do, and really, what kind of parameters does it have?
Yeah. So in 2019, Senator Chris Coons from Delaware and Rep. Judy Chu from California introduced the No Ban Act. And essentially what the No Ban Act does, it explicitly prohibits discrimination based on religion when it comes to granting visas, immigration benefits, or anything related to
religious freedom. Wait a minute. Wait. This is religious freedom. So you could say the No Ban Act supporting religious freedom.
I mean, this is essentially what it does.
Yes,
right?
I know. I'm saying that because I hear my evangelical Christians talking about the assault on religion, except the only assault they care about is the assault on their religion. Everybody else's religion could go under the bus.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, yes. And that's unfortunate. And I think that's what makes Islamophobia so much more palatable. That when we talk about freedom of religion, oftentimes people are thinking about certain religions, and we're not taking into consideration all religions when we think about Muslims and Islam, because Muslims and Islam have been demonized so long.
Exactly.
Again, this ban wasn't able to pass so easily because of what had happened since 2016 and Trump was elected. But the foundations of Islamophobia and anti-Muslim rhetoric has been set from decades ago.
Right.
They've been vilified in Hollywood, in movies, in media. We know that the coverage of Muslims is one-dimensional. It only talks about Muslims when we're talking about national security threats and terrorism. So Muslims have lost their humanity, essentially, which makes passing bills like this one so much more palatable and easier, to the point that we need to have a bill like the No Ban Act that explicitly says, hey, discriminating based off of religion in regards to immigration should be illegal, and we want to stop this current one and future ones. And so I think when we look about how we got here, it's not just post-2016 and post-Trump, but it's been the foundations that have been set, and things have just come into air and has been forefront and centered after the 2016 election.
You know, I keep thinking about the fact that, you know, we want to protect the separation of church and state. We also want to protect the freedom to express your faith. So I always tell people what is so amazing about what we did by the separation of church and state, by encouraging people to find their God, to find their faith, is that America, more than any other country in the world, has more places of worship per person than any country in the world. And that means worship. That means worship that whether you're a Buddhist, whether you're an evangelical Christian, whether you're a Jew, whether you're a Muslim, we sat here and said, celebrate your faith and your God. And it worked. And it worked because people felt they could come here and be safe. What messages are we sending now? That is what is so shocking. And then last but not least, you will love this because we need to hold on to these stories as we talk about the No Ban Act. Many, many years ago, a friend of mine was being asked, and he was the head of school board, that they wanted to have the creation story being included in the biology class. Okay? They needed to have that in the biology class. So I called them up and they kept fighting and fighting and fighting. And I said, no, no, don't fight. I got 12 creation myths right here. Tell them to pick six. Not just theirs. Pick six. How about the big turtle? How about the big? I said, what you want people to see is it's only their myth. It's only their faith. It isn't about freedom of religion. It's about freedom from my religion. And that's not what we do. And I think as you tell this story, which is so powerful, and you do such a phenomenal job, I hope also, because you mentioned Minnesota in this piece, it was really important that since Amy Klobuchar is talking about her experience, and her experience comes from a state that has more refugees than any other state in the nation per capita, that she has a moral obligation as well as a leadership obligation mm-hmm. to explain to the American people what does that mean. You know, what does that mean as we look at the future of our nation? Because she, quote unquote, has that experience. And nobody has really ever asked her that question.
Rowida, do you know if anybody has or if she's a sponsor or even a supporter of the bill?
I'm unsure if she herself is a supporter of the bill, but I think we've been paying attention to who is bringing up the bill and who is bringing up the travel ban consistently, I think, particularly in the debates. I was watching the last debate that happened last week, and not a single Democratic presidential candidate even brought up the fact that the travel ban was happening, despite the fact that it had, you know, Trump's announcement had just gone in. Mm-hmm. We've seen it come up in past debates. Former Governor Inslee had brought it up a couple of times. Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, Andrew Yang have mentioned it in terms of they would support the No Ban Act and revoke the travel ban. But I think we need to pressure all of the candidates a little bit more to talk about this. I don't think they're talking about it enough. Right. I don't think they're realizing, recognizing that you have an entire faith group that's being discriminated against, not through this piece of legislation, but through the rise of hate crimes against Muslims and refugees on the ground, and then against African Americans on the ground as well. And so I think this is something we hope will come up in the next debate that we hope is continuing to be in the news so people recognize we're doing this.
And I don't want to target Amy Klobuchar, but she's talking about her experience. That was the one thing she said with Pete Buttigieg. She kept saying, I have experience. This is her experience. What you have just written about is her experience. That other people bring up the No Ban Act and she does not raise questions for me. That she can't talk about this experience, which is so important because these people are marginalized. These people are being targeted. By who? By the racist in chief that we've elected president. So she is going to use her elbows against this man, and she wants to be the next president of the United States, then I want her to speak to this experience because more than anyone else on this stage, it is intimate to her because of where she comes from. So I do hope it is being brought up in the future, but I do want people to understand these are the kinds of questions that must be asked of the candidates. By avoiding them, we not only avoid not knowing what's happening by Donald Trump, but we avoid having the conversation that will help us address it. You are fabulous. Let me just say something. You are fabulous. Please, I will keep calling you, keep writing about this, keep reminding us about what needs to be front and center in our face. The distraction of his tweets, their distractions and lies. The content of your piece at HuffPost is what we need to hold on to. if we have a country that we want to recognize after the 2020 election.
Can I just add one thing to Roetta? I don't know how much you or your group has tried to talk to the candidates, but I'm active in the immigration movement, been down to the border in Brownsville, Texas, and Matamoros, Mexico, fighting the MPP program, and in Homestead, Florida, the children in cages. And we have had extreme difficulty getting any of the presidential candidates to even address the issue. And people like Pete Buttigieg just walk away when we ask the question. He literally just, he doesn't answer it, he turns and he walks away. That's his M.O.
And we
so
have to
I hope you're more successful than we are.
Exactly. I think that's what he's saying. Thank you so much for joining us. Thank you for informing us. And be prepared to be called again.
I'm looking forward to it. Thank you guys so much, and hopefully you all keep talking about it.
All right, we will. Take care. Thanks. All right, everyone, we end with, of course, this is a primary day in New Hampshire.
Yeah, it's a primary day. We end with The Right to Vote by Laura Nero.
Here we go.